Radio.
Arriving at Amen. A talk by Leah Labresco at Theology on Tap, held at La Pub in the Sydney CBD. This talk was provided by XT3.com.
For having me, and it's always fun to get to travel abroad and see what's different in the different countries. And I see here that Australia doesn't have any fire code regulations at all, so that's very exciting to learn. So I'll just start by saying a little about my conversion, which is, you know, it was kind of precipitated by finding the most interesting wrong people I knew and then trying to explain to them why they were wrong. And then when that didn't work, reading their books so I could explain in more detail why they were wrong, and eventually finding out they were right. And you know, for me, a lot of it started with the question of almost, you know, if the eye responds to light in the physical world, and that's what vision is, what does conscience respond to? And kind of playing around with that question. And for me, you know, the idea of weird transcendental truths wasn't that weird. I was a mathematician. I was used to the idea of there being true, beautiful things that were immaterial. But the more time I spent with the problem of how is it we come to have knowledge of the good versus how do we come to have knowledge of number theory, which to me felt like one of the highest goods. It was a much more complicated question, and ultimately it felt like it was much more probable that God existed, you know, and the Christian faith was true, and that was the reason I had for having knowledge, for having my conscience respond to something the way my eye responds to vision, than that God was false, and there was some other workaround that let me have knowledge of the transcendent even as a finite, limited person. And that's clearly the, you know, three-sentence version of my conversion. A lot of my friends got the four-hour version that started with, in the history of philosophy, there are three major schools of thought: utilitarianism, deontology, and virtue ethics. And went on, I swear, for 4 hours. We had cake during the discussion to kind of tide everyone over. But kind of for me, the interesting thing is that that tends to be the part that everyone else is interested in. You know, how did you change your mind? And for me, that doesn't feel like the major part of my conversion. It's almost as though in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when Lucy opens the door into Narnia, you know, you spend a lot of time going, oh, so you were playing hide and seek with your friends. Where did you think of hiding first? How did you come upon the cupboard, you know? What did the cupboard look like? Was it a draw pull or kind of, you know, a doorknob? Because the interesting thing is that a door opened, and then you have to figure out what you do next. You know, and my conversion story is rooted a lot in where I started, you know, which was as a very stubborn deontologist who was incredibly into mathematics, which is not where everyone else starts or finds their way in the same way that people find different ways into Narnia. But once you do find your way in, you have to figure out how to live differently in the world you now inhabit. And so for me, that's been the very challenging part, because up till then, you know, all of the philosophical figuring things out was something I was very used to knowing how to do. You know, in some ways, the process of my conversion wasn't that different from the papers I wrote in my philosophy class or the debates I had on Thursday nights. It was a long argument about what is true, and I liked having those, and I knew how. But once I changed my mind about what was true, I had to figure out what to do differently. And for me, prayer was an incredibly hard part of that. On the night I changed my mind about God, I was kind of lucky. I was with a friend, and I said, okay, you know, I changed my mind, you know, what should we do now? And he goes, we should pray the Liturgy of the Hours. It's great, you know, settled. But I couldn't carry him around everywhere, you know, to tell me how to continue my life as a Catholic. But I want to give you a sense of how hard kind of prayer felt to me, which is that there was one period before I actually converted when, you know, a friend of mine would just say, why don't you just try praying? I said, well, you know, there are two problems. One is that I don't believe in God. And the other is I don't, like, have an idea of how to pray anyway. I said, no. He's like, well, just say something to God. I'm like, no, I can't do that at all. Like, if you wanted me to do this, you could start praying, and then you could say, and now Leah will pray. And you kind of open the phone line, and you're passing over a phone, right? I kind of thought in that concrete term. I don't, like, know how to start this, but I trust that you know how to start this, so you start, and then just say it's my turn. And again, I couldn't rely on everyone else to do that for me all the time. So one thing, you know, I had the trouble of after my conversion, well, we're supposed to pray ceaselessly, you know, you can bring anything to God. And I didn't know how, that was much too big a project for me, right? Like, it kind of felt like you'd just be going along, you know, doing anything, you know, even giving this talk and go, you know, oh yes, and hi God, Roger, are you still there? You know, like, yes. And I didn't know how to do it. It felt like I'm almost like Instagram passing on trivialities, you know, here is my food. You know, here's the bus. Here are all of you. I can't even comment my code reliably when I'm writing computer programs. And that's supposed to be like helpful notes of what am I doing and how does this work that are kind of concrete and laid out, and I had trouble with that. You know, so what I really wanted to rely on was, and luckily in Catholicism, I have ritual, scripted prayers, things where I didn't have to figure out what to do. And one thing I turned to was the rosary, both because it's a very reasonably laid out prayer. I know how to start. I know to just keep going till I reach the end and stop. And I don't have to make up any of the words myself. So it seemed like that was a reasonable place to start. And there was nothing more Catholic than the rosary I could possibly think of. And even there I had trouble, because now I knew what to say. But, you know, the rosary says, you know, say 10 Hail Marys and meditate on this mystery. And I didn't know what to do when I meditated on a mystery. You know, should I just think about it the whole time? Am I supposed to have an insight? And I kept getting stuck, and I kind of got scared of praying the rosary, because what if I'm doing it wrong? You know, it's, I don't like to, you know, inconvenience other people. Am I inconveniencing God by praying badly? You know, is this like singing off key? And so I could kind of just do the form of it, right? I could start saying Hail Mary. I can definitely say that 10 times. But I didn't know what else to do. And so that's kind of, for me, you know, the point where I had to reach to something that wasn't Catholicism to help me figure out what to do with Catholic spirituality. Because to me, converting felt like learning a new language, but in the new language. My French textbook was in English when it explained to me how French worked. But the whole realm of spirituality was being explained to me in spiritual terms, and it was kind of going over my head. So I had this ritual thing where I'm just repeating the same prayer again and again, and something's supposed to be happening, but I don't really know what it is. And the more I think about it, kind of the more self-conscious I become. Oh, you know, am I praying this right? Am I praying this right? Oh, wait, I'm definitely not meditating on the life of Christ. I'm definitely meditating on my experience of this prayer. I think that's not right. Wait, now I'm meditating on the experience of meditating. I would get at like three levels of recursion. And the thing that wound up making sense of the rosary for me, kind of, was something that, you know, I kind of thought of as having nothing to do with Catholicism or religion or prayer at all. It was that in college I'd taken ballroom dance classes. And ballroom dance, you know, is the process of repeating some very simple motions all the time. If you've ever taken a dance class, you know, it often feels like what you'll start by doing is saying, well, you know, if you're a follow like I am, here's how you do a turn, you know, here's how you do a spin. And you don't start that way in class at all. You start by saying, here's the basic. Here are the basic steps that happen to the rhythm of this dance. And so if I were doing the cha-cha, for example, it's one, two, cha-cha-cha, three, four, cha-cha-cha. And the first couple of lessons are just that. They don't teach you turns, you know, they don't teach you like fancy kicks or anything. Because my only job is to actually pick up my feet and put them down at the right time. And so when I took the class, even, they told me, like, practice all the time. So I'd be on the subway platform, one, two, cha-cha-cha, three, four, cha-cha. And people definitely thought I was silly, but that wasn't my problem, that was their problem. I'd be waiting in line to, like, get lunch in university, so one, two, cha-cha-cha, three, four, cha-cha-cha. Because when I'm doing ballroom dance, I actually don't need to know all the steps that I'm executing. In fact, the more I do better, at least I do, because I overthink things, when I'm taking dancing with someone, if they're leading me through moves I haven't practiced or learned all the steps of, because when I know this turn, I start to anticipate, oh, I'm about to put my foot here, and I get off on timing. When all I'm doing is going, I'm picking up my foot, I'm putting it down on the rhythm, then the other person is the one who moves me, and I wind up in the right spot. And I thought the rosary was actually something like that. You know, I actually have a much smaller job than I was kind of assigning to myself at the beginning of the Rosary. My job is not to acquire new theological insights into the life of Christ, you know, for example. My job is not, you know, to meditate successfully. You know, my job, like it was on the subway platform, is just to perform a small, simple movement that means I'm moving in the right rhythm and can move if someone else moves me. That it's a simple, repeated motion, a repeated prayer that gives me the opportunity, you know, to do anything else. And that made the Rosary a little easier for me. It made it so I could approach it. But, you know, I still had some trouble, and part of the problem was that I started by doing only the Sorrowful Mysteries. which in retrospect was a really weird choice. I thought I should pick up a Friday discipline, and the Sorrowful Mysteries are assigned to Friday, so I kind of had an always winter and never Christmas of a prayer life. But it was also hard because the Sorrowful Mysteries, the Scourging at the Pillar, the Crown of Thorns, Garden of Gethsemane, the Scourging at the Pillar, the Crown of Thorns, the Procession to the Crucifixion, and then the Crucifixion, were the scariest possible mysteries for me to meditate on. You know, I was just starting in my prayer life, and then I'm supposed to spend 10 Hail Marys thinking about the Crucifixion. And it was, I didn't want to approach this unworthily, so I kind of compromised by going, let me not do this at all, and I'll be sure I'm not doing it badly. And so what I actually did is I just flinched productively, I think. I was really scared to try to meditate on these or make it my own task to extract meaning, and to look at Christ in the complete midst of his suffering and make this make sense to me. So I didn't. I said, I will look at the periphery of these stories and see if that helps. Because it feels very weird or scary or beyond me to go right to the center. I'm going to just look right at the edge. And when I say that, what I mean is when I thought about the garden of about the crown of thorns, I went, huh, that sounds very difficult to think about. I'm going to just like step even back in time. Someone made the crown of thorns. I can think about that. And that was like something, right? That was a physical experience. The interesting thing about a crown of thorns, you know, unlike even the whip, when you make a whip, you're braiding fibers. It has no link to what it will be used for. It's not different to make a whip than it is to make a rope. But to braid a crown of thorns, you're going to hurt yourself the whole time braiding them. You're going to feel the pain you're planning for someone else just by assembling this crown. And that pain I could think about because it was small, it was human, it was farther away. And, you know, it gave me room because I kind of let myself nervously back away from the main mystery to say, well, you know, imagine someone doing that. And what would it take to feel the pain you were preparing for someone else and to keep working on this anyway? You know, I never do anything like that. Or when I do something like that, I actually do know what that feels like. You know, I can imagine someone braiding the crown of thorns and doing a really good braid, you know, versus just a loop. They're going, oh, you know, this is important. This is about heresy, you know. I'm going to do a nice-looking one. We're going to do this in front of everyone. To the point where even as you're hurting yourself, you're going, wow, I'm so committed to this. It's hurting me, and I'm doing this anyway. I must be really brave. You know, I'm strong enough to bear this pain because I think it's important. And that's a feeling I have all the time, and not a feeling I should always trust when it comes to me. That I'm, just by virtue of enduring something, must be making a good decision because I'm willing to take suffering on myself. And so that was kind of a way for me to find, you know, a way kind of just around the edge of the mystery and say, wow, for someone else to prepare this crown of thorns, they had to hurt themselves. They had to be able to lose their empathy for the person they were hurting. What does it take to lose that empathy, and how do I do that myself? So a lot of the time, my experience of prayer has really been of kind of finding a guide wire across. There's a thing if you're building a bridge where you really only need to get one rope across the span. It can be a really, really tiny one, and that's your pilot line. And, you know, a lot of my prayer life is trying to find a pilot line rather than trying to figure out how to pray really well. Because every time I try that one, it definitely doesn't work. So for the Niagara Falls Bridge, for example, which is an enormous span of water, horrible rapids, terribly dangerous, the pilot line was a kite. that someone, they got a little boy to fly a kite over Niagara Falls. So now you have one strand connecting this bank to the other side of the bridge, to the other side of the eventual bridge. You know, and it's a kite string, right? You know, easy to break, small, unrelated almost to the bridge that will follow. But because you have one strand that goes all the way across both banks, you can tie a little nylon fiber to it and pull it across using the kite string. Then you can tie a tiny steel fiber to it and pull it across using the kite string. So for a lot of my prayer life, what I try and do is to say, wow, you know, this is quite difficult. My job in prayer is not to solve the problem of how hard prayer is. It's to find the smallest possible thing I definitely can offer and to send it across as a pilot line. And maybe after I do that, you know, the next step will be easier and I can do something else. Maybe after that, the next step is even easier, or maybe I'm given grace to do something else, but I don't have to build, like, lower the bridge across on the first step. I have to find a way to offer a pilot line. You know, and a lot of the time, that's what my petitionary prayer looks like, too, because I've kind of had the experience, you know, as I've gone on, I've gotten a little braver about kind of talking to God without someone connecting the phone first and passing it on to me. But I'll have moments where it's clear that what I should be praying for, you know, is to love someone better, right? Or to even forgive them. And I just definitely cannot do it in that moment at all. And so sometimes what I would do at first, before I kind of thought in terms of pilot lines, is to go, okay, you know, I'm not succeeding at praying for this person. I should just leave this prayer project here, and I'll come back to it when I'm better. You know, later I'll be less angry. Later I can make this prayer in good faith. I do want to forgive them. But I can't right now, so I'll go work on my own privately somewhere and come back. And for me, that's almost like the same temptation if I shouldn't pray the rosary until I'm already doing it well. You know, it's a reluctance to practice or to offer God anything but what would be my idealized best effort, which I'm not capable of today. But in the meantime, I'm not getting any better at it. So instead, I try and take that pilot line approach and go, okay, I definitely should be praying to forgive this person, or even better than that, just to love them and, you know, move past this. But I definitely cannot this second. Well, I could pray to be able to pray to forgive them. That might actually be something I feel like I can say yes to. I can't honestly say I want to forgive them. It's not true. You know, I don't want to have the habit of offering prayers that aren't true to God, even if they're the prayers I wish I were making. To just have a habit of lying to God in prayer. So I don't want to forgive this person, but I wish I were able to. That's what I'm asking for today. Tomorrow, hopefully, I'll ask to forgive them. And the day after, hopefully, I'll ask to love them, but today I'm asking to be able to ask to forgive. Sometimes that one doesn't work for me. You might be more patient than I am. So then I say, wow, you know, I wish I could ask to be able to ask to forgive this person. That would be good. But I don't even want to be able to forgive them at this moment. So I kind of, like, step back. And I'll tell you, you know, this isn't... It could be an infinite line of dominoes that I try and set up where, you know, the nice thing about it is as long as God grants whichever prayer I'm able to make, I wish I were able to ask to be able to ask to forgive this person, then I can make the next one and have it granted. So I could kind of take the infinite dominoes chain approach and just go, I wish I were able to ask, exponential, ask, eventually. But one thing I even back up to at that point is when I get stuck, and I feel like I'm even losing count of how many steps backwards I'm going, especially for interpersonal prayers, what I tend to do then is just go, wow, Mary, I wish you would solve this. Because that's what it feels like, is it almost is at the point where I am squabbling with this person, I don't want to be reconciled to this person, and I don't even want to think about them, but I can go, Mary, you like this person, and you like me. I don't really feel that good about them at the moment. This sounds like this is your problem. And my role, my pilot line, is delegating in this moment. I am delegating this task to you. As our mutual mother, like if there's one thing parents know how to deal with, it is siblings who are not getting along and am loving them both, right, at the same time. Even if one person, the other one, is in the wrong. That, you know, Mary as a mother never wants justice. She wants mercy. She wants both people to be reconciled to each other. She doesn't want one person to be punished enough that the other person is satisfied. And that is not always true of me. So what I can say is, Mary, please resolve this in some way so I can make a satisfactory prayer. And that's my pilot line. that to me. Because if it's granted, I can go on to everything else along the way. It's all for me a matter of setting up dominoes. So one thing I wind up talking about, you know, I want to leave time for questions about specific prayer practice, but you know, one thing I wind up talking about in my book, Arriving at Amen, where I'm talking about a lot of different prayer practices I explored as a new Catholic and the way I kind of snuck my way into a lot of them, is that for me, a lot of it was just finding a way to offer any kind of pilot line, some way I could offer a very, very, very small prayer, one that I wasn't going to be terrified of doing badly, one that was short even. You know, sometimes if I'm angry at someone, I can't even think about what I want to pray. I say just one Hail Mary because it's 30 seconds and I know I can do it. And to think like, what should I pray for this person? Even giving myself the task of coming up with a new prayer at that moment is too much for me while I'm angry. What's the smallest thing I can do that allows me to offer goodwill to this person and to involve God? But sometimes, you know, it was a lot of very small, almost even in some cases, technological fixes. I was scared of doing Lectio Divina, too, of doing kind of prayerful Bible reading. Again, for me, a lot of times the same problem. I didn't want to do it badly. I had two fears. I didn't want to do it badly. I was afraid it might go on forever, which I realize sounds like a crazy fear. But I kind of thought, well, what if I start and I open the book and I don't know when I'm allowed to stop? I might want to stop after 5 minutes, and that's probably wrong. But if I can't stop, then when can I stop? You know, what if this is my whole night? Oh, I probably don't have time. What if it is my whole night? What if it's really good? And if I started now, I wouldn't have time to pray really well. And again, nothing happened for me. And so there, even part of it is I kept never, ever, ever doing it. I said, all right, I notice I'm really frightened of, you know, how long this is going to take. So I'm deciding now. I'm setting a timer for 20 minutes. And when it goes off, I get to stop, no matter what. You know, if I want to keep going, I can, but I definitely, it's okay. And it's a way of giving myself permissions to start at all, which is something I've done a lot whenever I try a new prayer practice, is to find a very small way of doing it. You know, whether it's doing something from a book or doing it with a friend or doing a very small version of it time-wise, or even just picking out ahead of time the specific time at which I'll do it, so that no part of my prayer practice is the like difficult scheduling problem of, when will I choose to do this? Which is usually enough to derail it entirely for me. That's too heavy a line for the first line for the bridge. When will I do this? That has to already be in place, not at the moment where I'm trying to pray. So it's like, oh yes, I will do this on my commute. Good, now that's settled. Now I can try divine office. And how will I do divine office? I will open it on my phone, you know, everything as easy as possible. I really kind of baby myself along. And the reason, you know, I wind up feeling okay about this is because prayer, you know, I kind of approached prayer originally as a big task for me, right? You know, how will I pray as well as possible? Okay, I'm used to trying to find ways to excel at things, trying to find the ways to do something impressively. You know, if I'm going to a Halloween costume, it should involve some new way of artificing that I've never tried before. Everything should demonstrate a new skill. And that would be a really strange way to treat a friendship. You know, oh, well, the next time I have dinner with this person, I have to do something new for them. Something about my meeting with them has to show my own effort and mastery. And so having permission to have prayer be small and to have prayer be, you know, a matter of opening a door on my side, you know, not blocking God out, of just making a little space where there's time and quiet and ritual for God to enter into my life rather than me being busy with everything else, has helped me a lot to be able to pray at all. And the last thing I'd kind of like to say before I go over, you know, into questions or anything else, is the other task for me has really been being comfortable praying to God in the language I do speak, you know, rather than in a new language that I don't know. So for me, a lot of the time when I was just starting to pray, I had trouble because I wasn't used to thinking about God at all. You know, I was thinking of him as an intellectual proposition. And it's very weird to pray to an intellectual proposition. You might think it's impossible, but it's not, because that is definitely what I was trying. I'd go, okay, God, like, I do believe that he exists, but I don't have much practice thinking about him, but he's the true, the good, and the beautiful. I have some level of experience with this. It sounds rather like math. You know, I know how to think about math. And I'd be sitting down praying, and I go, I am definitely thinking about the Riemann hypothesis and not about God. But I don't know how to like make one more jump here. And what I would do is go, well, like I am thinking about the Riemann hypothesis, and I love the Riemann hypothesis. And the Riemann hypothesis, you know, is part of the true, the good, and the beautiful. especially the beautiful. And if I love it, like, God loves it too, because it is beautiful and true. So I am actually sharing a moment here. You know, in the way that you do when you have your friends see a movie you love, right? You turn to them and go, this moment, right? This is a great moment. And I'm doing that with God right now. We're both thinking about the Riemann hypothesis because he's on there and I happen to be thinking about it the second. And if I delight in it, how much more does he delight in it? And delight in my delight. And if I love the Riemann hypothesis this much, and it's a mathematical theorem, it's hard for me even to say just a mathematical, but it's just a mathematical theorem. And I'm a living creature in the image of God. You know, God loves the Riemann hypothesis, but how much more does he love me? So making space all along the way that wherever I can find beauty that kind of puts me back to Catholicism, that it is actually an opening, not just for it to explain something for me, but me to go, wow, like, that was cool to see. Did you see that? How beautiful is this? I'll give one last example of a thing I happen to find particularly beautiful, and then I'll turn it over to questions. So this is just one I particularly love. So I like, in the same way with the movie, I just want to share it all with you. You know, when I was starting to do confession, going to confession, it seemed like that was the kind of part of Catholic spirituality I never heard anyone talk about, right? Because it's kind of, oh, you know, I went to confession last week. You wouldn't go, oh, you know, I didn't think you'd go, oh, how beautiful. You go, oh, you did, huh? Because it seemed like a process of saying, like, oh, you've done bad things. This is what happens afterwards. We don't like talking about bad things. It'd be weird to talk about the evidence you've done bad things. And so for me, one thing that helped me find my way into confession was one of those kind of moments of reaching out to a different frame of reference is that there's this method of Japanese pottery repair, which is rather like confession, you know, if you look at it at the right angle. It's called kintsugi. And what it basically is that you've broken a pot. Normally, you might try and repair it as seamlessly as possible. But in this case, maybe it's not possible. You've lost too much of it, you know, in cracking. Or maybe you actually want to do something very special for this pot. So you repair it with an enamel that's got gold leaf in it. So you don't have kind of an invisible glued together break where you can't see the line at all. You've got a vein of gold running along the crack that's more precious than the original pot. And that seemed like that was actually kind of what confession was. It wasn't a case of just, oh, you did a bad thing. That was terrible. But you're better now, right? Status quo antebellum, go forward. It was a process, it was a way of healing that didn't erase a wound. A way of mending that didn't erase the crack, but transfigured it and made it beautiful. Because if I just thought about confession as I made a list of everything bad I did, and then someone said, you know, that it would be okay going forward, I couldn't imagine talking to anyone about that. That sounds horrible. But I thought about it as, well, this is a process of taking what was already a wound and transfiguring it so that it becomes a mark of healing, and not an invisible one, a mark of healing that is itself beautiful, that draws your eye back to you in a different light and leads you to rejoice in it. That was something I could imagine talking about and could imagine doing. And it's also the kind of thing where I go, wow, this Japanese pottery repair technique, you know, didn't exist, you know, all throughout history so that I could use it to figure out what confession was. But it does this one additional beautiful thing. It mends pots beautifully, and it mends my idea of what confession is beautifully. Wow. It leaves me wondering kind of what else is next. When I look out into the whole world to see how everything I've loved already, basically, can illuminate my new faith. What other surprises are there for me as an additional tie back? Thank you.
That was Leila Bresco with her talk, Arriving at Amen, from Theology on Tap. Theology on Tap is held at Le Pub in the Sydney CBD. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.